Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We'll be reading today CQ Magazine, Amateur Radio Communications and Technology, the September 2008 issue. This is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801, United States of America. The editor, Richard Mawson, W2VU. The managing editor, Gail M. Schreiber, K2RED. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org, and that's spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. One word, handyham@courage.org. The website, http://www.handyham.org. Well, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who listen to the Courage Handy Ham System quite often realize that you've never heard CQ Magazine read in digest form here on the Internet or on the CDs or cassettes that you receive at home. However, because of the fact that the National Library Service has apparently gone to a rather extended period of production time in presenting the magazine on a somewhat timely basis, we have decided at the Courage Handy Ham System to offer it to you in digest form similar to QST Magazine or World Radio. I've been privileged to read all those publications over the years. Now, mind you, I've never really read the material or the categories within this particular publication. So, although I've looked at it for a few moments beforehand, trying to figure out how I'm going to give it to you, I hope you'll forgive me if I don't quite give it to you in the same fashion you've been hearing it from whoever's been reading it for you over the years through the National Library Service of Congress. However, before we begin, ladies and gentlemen, as you listen to this presentation of CQ Magazine here on the Courage Handy Ham System, if you would like to contact me directly via the Internet, if you have computer capabilities and Internet connections, my email is as follows. I would be delighted to hear from any or all of you as to how you would suggest I approach the readings in future attempts. My email is as follows. It is my call sign, all lowercase, N1BLF, at comcast.net. So that's November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, N1BLF at comcast.net. I would be very pleased to hear from you for any kind of commentary, negative or positive, and any instructional commentary you might want to choose as well. Or if you feel more comfortable, you can give a contact by way of telephone or whatever to Pat Tice, the General Director of the Courage Handy Ham System, and any comments worthy of talking about and discussing. Pat and I will get back to you on the very subject you comment to. So now let's begin. CQ Magazine, in digest form for September 2008 here on the Courage Handy Ham System. We'll begin with ham radio news. NASA, nothing's wrong with the sun. Responding to reports that the current solar minimum is lasting, quoting, longer than it should, close quote, and that this might be the beginning of another Maunder minimum, a 70-year stretch from the mid-1600s to the late 1700s, during which there were very few sunspots. NASA solar physicist David Hathaway says there is nothing to worry about within historic norms for the solar cycle. He told NASA Science News. He dismissed talk of a second Maunder minimum, noting that we have already observed a few sunspots from the next solar cycle. This suggests that the solar cycle is progressing normally. Hathaway predicted the next solar maximum will be just 3 or 4 years away. trouble with HF digital voice programs. The story was still developing as we went to press, but it appears that a significant legal issue has arisen regarding ham's rights to use the engine behind several new HF digital voice modes, including WinDRM, DRMDV, and FDMDV. According to Gary Pierce, call KN4AQ of Amateur Radio / Video News, all of these programs use a codec, that's CODEC, or coding and decoding algorithm known as MELP, which was designed for the U.S. military and for NATO, but apparently never licensed for free distribution to or use by hams. In response, the original versions of the software were pulled out of distribution and developers quickly changed WinDRM and FDMDV to work around an open source code. At press time, the revised version of FDMDV was back online and an updated WinDRM program was expected soon. In parentheses, DRMDV, which never really caught on, has been dropped, close parentheses. Pierce says users of these programs will need to download the new version to stay compatible and legal. He also notes that the audio quality is not as good in the newer version as in the original, because the original codec was designed specifically for HF use. In parentheses, note that a different codec is used by the AOR, digital voice modems, and by D-Star, so they were not affected by the situation. Close parentheses. Continuing in ham radio news, Riley retires, for real this time. The man who brought law and order back to amateur radio has retired. FCC Special Counsel Riley Hollingsworth, call K4ZDH, wrote his final warning notice on June 26 to a coal mining company using 2-meter radios in its mines, then hung up his pink slips on July the 3rd. He had originally planned to retire this past January, but changed his mind when an interference problem cropped up between several 170-centimeter amateur repeaters and the Air Force PAVE PAWS radar system. Not wanting to drop such a sensitive matter into the lap of a newcomer, Hollingsworth decided to delay his retirement till the immediate problems were resolved and a mechanism was in place to deal with future problems. For the past 10 years, Hollingsworth has been the face of FCC enforcement in the amateur service, assigned to be the chief enforcer of Part 97 of the FCC rules as part of a commission-wide effort in the late 1990s to put teeth back into its enforcement efforts. The ham bands, in particular, had been a virtual enforcement void since the mid-1980s. Riley's quick to assure anyone who asks that his departure will not mean an end to amateur enforcement and that a qualified successor, not yet named at press time, will pick up where he left off. Riley plans to remain involved in amateur radio, starting by spending more time on the air. Now back to the ARRL, the FCC meet on BPL, broadband over power lines. Top officials of the ARRL met with staff members of the FCC's Office of Engineering and Technology in July to discuss a possible regulatory approach for broadband over power lines, or BPL, after the U.S. Court of Appeals sent the FCC's BPL rules back to the Commission after deciding that two of ARRL's major complaints were correct. According to the ARRL letter, League President Joel Harrison, call W5ZN, Chief Executive Officer David Sumner, call K1ZZ, and General Counsel Chris Imlay, call W3KD, made proposals that, quoting, would address the needs and concerns of amateur radio operators in avoiding harmful interference while imposing a minimum necessary regulatory obligations on BPL deployments. Close quote. There was no indication as to whether the FCC staff was receptive to those proposals. Meanwhile, the Court of Appeals ordered the FCC to reimburse a portion of the ARRL's expenses relating to the suit over the BPL rules. There's a very interesting commentary relative to the ARRL and the Red Cross. Still some problems with background checks. The ARRL has notified the American Red Cross that a few sticking points remain with regard to the Red Cross policy requiring background checks for all volunteers, including those volunteering indirectly through ARRL's Amateur Radio Emergency Service. In a letter, ARRL President Joel Harrison, called W5CN, says the language in the authorization of background investigation consent form and the disclosure regarding background investigation form is still overly broad and may, quoting, discourage substantial numbers of radio amateurs from participating, close quote. However, he also made a point of saying that discussions on a renewed statement of understanding between the two organizations should not be delayed while these matters are resolved. A formal agreement between ARRL and Red Cross expired in 2007. Renewal talks were initially put on hold until the dispute over the background check could be resolved. And lastly, in Ham Radio News, Kansas Ham, son, killed during antenna installation. Edward Thomas, called KC0TIG, and his son Jacob, both of Kansas City, Missouri, were killed July 13th when an antenna they were installing apparently came in contact with high-voltage overhead electrical lines. According to the ARRL letter, Thomas, a ham since 2004, was declared dead at the scene from electrocution. His son died later in the day at the hospital. A local ham who works for the power company and says he built and maintained the substation that served Thomas's neighborhood says the overhead line carried 7,620 volts. He noted that the antenna they were installing was fiberglass, but pointed out that the fiberglass merely covers a metal radiating element and that a thin coating of fiberglass is no match for 7,000 volts. He reminds everyone, and we join him, that antennas and power lines do not mix. Any antenna should be installed far enough away from any power line that it can fall in any direction without making contact or even coming close. Now, for you listeners, if you want additional and updated news that's available on the Ham Radio News page of CQ Magazine website, go to http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com. For breaking news stories plus information on additional items of interest, sign up for CQ's free online newsletter service. Just click on CQ Newsletter on the homepage of their website. Next up in our digest recording of CQ for September 2008, Zero Bias, a CQ editorial. The author, Rich Mosen, I believe that's the right pronunciation. Rich spells his last name M-O-S-E-S-O-N. Mosen. His call is a W2VU, Whiskey 2 Victor uniform. He titles this Vanishing Act, question mark. What does ham radio have in common with wild horses and pit toilets? Well, according to America Online, all three are among the top 25 things vanishing from America. And that's a quotation from America Online. Unfortunately, there is no indication from the editors of WalletPop.com, part of AOL's Money and Finance, as to what their criteria were for selecting items for the list or for assessing the qualifications of the writers of each segment. Also, unfortunately, the piece was a main page feature on AOL the day it appeared, so it was promoted to several million AOL users. Also, unfortunately, well, fortunately in the largest sense, the story was wrong. at least in certain key points. Author Tom Barlow, call in 8NLO, whose credentials appear to include being a writer and holding a ham license, says that in the past 5 years, this is a quote, the number of people holding active licenses has dropped by 50,000. He follows that by saying, as cell phones and the internet siphon off much of what once attracted people to amateur radio, the nation's ham radio population is graying rapidly. All these elements speak to a long, slow diminishment of a pastime that began with Marconi. Close quote. There is no denying that our total licensing numbers have fallen in the past 5 years, and I wouldn't even quibble too much with Tom's numbers. The actual drop was 33,000 from 2003 to 2007, with a growth of 4,000 from 2007 through 2008. So he's only half off by roughly a factor of two. But let's look at some important background to these numbers. The total number of licensees started falling in May of 2003, after reaching an all-time high of nearly 688,000, according to the AHOA website. That date is significant because it is just over 12 years from February 1991, when the first codeless technician licenses were issued. At that time, there were indeed many people who were attracted to ham radio by repeater auto patches for making phone calls from their cars and so-called free email via packet that operated at about the same speed as, or faster than, your typical dial-up computer modem of the day. As cell phones became ubiquitous and internet connections became faster and faster, many of the people who became ham solely to make phone calls or send emails did indeed drop off. Most of them had never really become part of the ham community, but their licenses remained on the FCC books for a full 10 years, plus a 2-year grace period for renewal. Those first codeless tech licensees that were not renewed began falling off the FCC's rolls in early 2003, exactly the point at which our overall numbers began to drop. Over the same period, though, there have been between 20,000 and 30,000 new licensees each year. So in the 4 years in which we lost 33,000 licensees overall, we also gained about 100,000 new real people, and now the overall trend is upward. An interesting page to look at on the AHOA website is his average months to expiration page. This is the figure that resets when a license is renewed. Anyone with more than 60 months remaining has either renewed or been issued a new license within the past 5 years. Between late 2000 and mid-2004, the trend was negative, with the average licensee being less than 5 years away from expiration. But the numbers have been climbing steadily since the middle of 2004, and except for novice licensees, all license classes have been over 60 months since October 2006. In the most recent 3 months, that's April, May, June, 08, the average ham was about 68.2 months away from license expiration, an all-time high since AH0A began tallying these figures in 1999. And folks, I note here that call sign is actuated here as AH0A. That's not the way it was printed the last several times I mentioned it. So if it is indeed a ham radio call sign, it's not that I read it incorrectly. This is the first time the zero actually appeared in the Alpha Hotel 0A when they began tallying those figures in 1999. What this means is that the average ham today is operating with a license that has been issued or renewed within the past 5 years. And this is a very healthy sign for our future. The author continues with a subsection titled, Shooting Ourselves in the Foot. What does worry me, though, is our collective tendency to shoot ourselves in the foot, especially when we create a negative image of ham radio in an effort to promote it. A recent article in the Rochester Democrat Chronicle newspaper about a high school radio club quoted its advisor as saying, "There's no secret that ham radio is an older man's hobby. If we can get young kids interested, maybe we'll save the hobby from extinction." Thanks a lot, Guy. Of course, we don't really know how many young people are getting at the ham radio these days because the FCC no longer releases birth date information. Many of us who are active today got our starts as teenagers, and we tend to think that there was much greater interest in ham radio among teenagers 30 or 40 years ago than there is to now. I'm not so sure about that. My high school radio club had about 10 members and a half dozen licensed hams out of several hundred students in the school. One of our local radio clubs made a point of inviting us to attend its meetings and join its activities, but we were the only kids there, maybe two or three at a time. The rest of the club was made up of older men. Elsewhere in this issue, you will see our report on this year's Newsline Young Ham of the Year, Emily Stewart. She's a YL, young lady, called KC0PTL, who is neither old nor a man. Neither are the six other young women among this year's 30 YHOTY nominees. The article also includes a rundown of this year's scholarship winners from the Foundation for Amateur Radio. Of the 49 winners, 14 are young women. Last month, we pointed out the work done by ARRL membership manager Katie Breen, Katie's call sign is W1KRB, on revitalizing the ARRL staff radio club. Katie, again, is neither old nor a man. I think we're seeing a trend here, but it's not the one that's being shared with the media by so many other hams. Call sign N8NLO, the author of the 80L piece, responding to the many comments disagreeing with his perspective, said he hopes they are right, but that I've seen local clubs no longer able to field volunteers for events or hold field day. That may be so. And one could argue that the hobby is in trouble if the staff radio club at its national organization headquarters was falling into inactivity. But the real story there is how two of those staff members, one young and inexperienced as a ham, managed to turn it all around. On a similar note, Ted Randell, WB8PUM, who produces a radio program about ham radio on international shortwave, has a story on his website. That website is www.tedrandall, that's TEDRANDALL.com/pages/good-stuff.php, about a new young ham in Tennessee who was looking forward to attending his first ham fest when he learned that the sponsoring club had been disbanded and that the ham fest would be canceled. John Rhodes, called KJ4EVN, got in touch with another young ham, Matt Klimkowski, KG4WXX, and along with a couple of other young hams decided to try to run the ham fest on their own. When word of the effort reached Dr. Michael Barrett, president of TW Antennas in nearby Cookville, there's a review of the TW2010 in this issue, he immediately agreed to sponsor the Hempfest and cover the costs. So not only was admission free, but so was the food. Attendance wasn't great, as there was still confusion over whether the event was on or off. What really matters, though, is that this group of young hams is already hard at work planning next year's Ham Fest. Now, one final note. One of my son's friends from high school is a film major in college. Assigned to produce a mini-documentary for a class, he picked ham radio as his topic. I don't know if he ever finished the program, but along the way, he went out and got his tech licenses, and last I heard, he was teaching himself Morse code. You know, maybe they're right. Maybe this hobby of old men is dying and being replaced by a hobby led increasingly by young men and women who aren't always satisfied with toys that other people have built, but want to build and design their own toys for the rest of us to play with. Ham radio is dead. Long live ham radio. It's signed 73. Call W2VO. Rich Mosen. Now, folks, before I leave this zero-beat editorial page, if you would like to contact the author, Rich Mosen, M-O-S-E-S-O-N, Rich's call is W2VU. You can send him email at that call sign, lowercase, W2VU, at CQ-amateur-radio.com. You have many thoughts or comments you have about the vanishing act of ham radio. Ladies and gentlemen, as you continue to listen to me reading, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1 Bravo Lima Foxtrot, here on the Courage Handy Hemp System. There is the results of the 2007 CQ Worldwide DX CW contest. This is a really big thing for CQ Magazine. This is our first effort at presenting digest form contact to you for CQ Magazine, but the actual Worldwide DX contest and other major contests by CQ are very, very well known and regarded. The results for the previous contest this year, the CQ 2007 Worldwide DX Contest for CW, is always an event looked forward to by many contesters around the world. You never know what propagation will provide, but you can be sure the CQ Worldwide will provide activity from stations located in exotic locations. Lots of activity was heard as contesters filled the airwaves. Once again, the propagation favored the low bands. 160 really showed what it could provide with several stations working over 100 countries. Look at the scores, which are on these pages, from page 13 through page 23. So there's a lot of print here, a lot of statistics, a lot of winners, a lot of commentary. But I can't give it all to you because as we read these things in digest form, not just CQ Magazine, but also QST from the ARRL and World Radio from Armand Noble in California, we have to refer you to the pages sometimes. And if there is very pertinent, specific information you'd like to see for yourself or have someone read to you, you have to get a copy of CQ for September 2008 or have a friend in one of the ham radio clubs nearby to you to help you with that as an elmer or a helper to get you the information. As I continue to scan forward through the magazine, I see an article here by an old friend, Gordon West. Gordon's call is WB6NOA. This is a CQ review. It's of the TW antennas, TW-2010, Traveler, which is trademarked, portable HF antenna. Gordo tests a new 5-band portable Traveler from TW antennas in his backyard with promising results. Gordy's results appear on page 24 through page 29 of CQ Magazine for September 2008. The very last commentary from Gordy says that the list price for the TW-2010 Traveler is somewhere in the range of about $400 American, a complete package, which includes the antenna plus the quad pad stand and a deluxe carrying case. It's a little bit more money if you throw in the shipping and so forth. For more information, you can visit the website of TW Antennas. It's http://www.antennas.com. uppercase TW, lowercase antennas. So that's twantennas.com on the web. And look for product number TW-2010. But before I leave the article, as an addition to that, there's a second test. A friend of Gordo's, Paul Bailey Gates, called KA6GEM, recently purchased his own TW-2010 and recounted his initial impressions. I set up the TW-2010 this afternoon in my front yard just to test it out. I soldered a set of Anderson power poles, registered, onto the control power line and grounded everything as recommended. I'm using a new 75-foot length of RG8X from Cable Experts. Everything worked as expected, but the bands were dead, so I didn't make a single contact or hear any activity. The SWR meter on my FT-8970 didn't move at all. In fact, my first impression was that something wasn't working. The only problem I had was in the auto mode, using the accessory Yaesu interface cable with my FT-8970. It switched okay for the 10 and 12 meter bands. But when I switched to 15, it jumped back to 10 meters. Same for 17 and 20 meters. But the manual mode works so well that the auto mode almost seems unnecessary. This antenna could prove to be a major game changer. Its setup was super simple and there was no tuning. With the growing number of very portable HF transceivers, for instance, ICOM's new IC7000 and the venerable 706, Yaesu's FT897 and 857, and Kenwood's TS2000, among others, there is, I think, a lot of demand for an antenna like this. And that concludes the commentary on the TW-2010 by TWantennas.com. Folks, it was mentioned once or twice anyway already by me in this issue of CQ Magazine about young hams. Here's a commentary. Young hams shine with awards, scholarships. Again, the author is Rich Mossen, W2VO. Before the text, the quality of young people in ham radio may not be as high as many of us would like, but there is no problem with the quality of those young hams, representing today's leaders not only of our hobby, but of their professions as well. The accomplishments of young people in amateur radio were highlighted in late June and early July by two separate announcements. One, the winner of this year's Newsline Young Ham of the Year. The acronym is YHOTY award. And the other, the more than four dozen young amateurs honored with scholarship administered by the Foundation for Amateur Radio, FAR. We begin with Emily M. Stewart, call KC0PTL, Kilo Charlie 0, Papa Tango Lima. 17-year-old Emily Stewart, KC0PTL, was chosen from a record field of 30 nominees to be the 2008 Newsline Young Ham of the Year. Emily is entering her senior year in Leavenworth, Kansas High School and hopes to become a pharmacist in the future. She has been a ham for 5 years and has been involved with promoting and demonstrating amateur radio for nearly as long. In 2006, she was appointed ARRL Assistant Section Manager for Youth in Kansas and helped organize and run the Youth Lounge and Youth Dinner at the Dayton Hamvention in both 2007 and 2008. At a section leadership meeting in 2007, Emily asked how many of the attendees had persuaded their children or grandchildren to become hams. Very few hands were raised. As a result, she and Brian Short, called KC0BS, developed the Kansas Legacy Project, a program designed to encourage licensed hams to get their younger family members involved in the hobby. Emily herself is the daughter of a ham, Mike Stewart, called K0MDS. at a ceremony at the Huntsville Hemp Fest in August. Emily was due to be presented with a plaque from Amateur Radio Newsline, along with the Yaesu transceiver from corporate co-sponsor Vertex Standard, and a week at Space Camp Huntsville from CQ Magazine, also a corporate co-sponsor. There was a full-color photograph of Emily M. Stewart called KC0PTL, Newsline Young Ham of the Year, 2008. It's on page 30 of CQ for September 2008. Now, the article goes on at some length, describing all of the additional scholarships won by various participants, beginning with the commentary by the FAR scholarship winners, the Foundation of Amateur Radio. That commentary and the complete list appears on pages 30 and 31 of CQ, September 2008. As I move along in the magazine, we're up to the 35 to 36 minute mark of our recording and digest form here on the Courage Handyham system. A lot of wonderful stuff in CQ magazine. But here, I'll slow down and give you Beginner's Corner. The author is Wayne Yoshida, called KH6WZ, Kilo Hotel 6, Whiskey Zulu. It's titled, Do We Have the Wrong Stuff or the Right Stuff When on the Radio? I was in my favorite coffee shop having breakfast with a friend on a recent Sunday morning. We were discussing our latest home improvement projects and various other topics. Suddenly, our conversation was interrupted by an obnoxiously loud and irritatingly poor ringtone somewhere behind us. We had to endure several seconds of the song, and then a woman answered the phone. She must have had a hearing problem, because even though she was at least 8 or so feet away, we clearly heard every word she said. The cell phone lady carried on about some real estate property deal and how much she knew the person on the other side of the telephone would love it. Miss Cell Phone had a breakfast partner who had to silently eat her meal as she was being ignored by her real estate friend. I was rather offended by several things in this intrusive behavior. First, Miss Cell Phone's ringtone was so loud that it must have been on the loudest volume setting, and she actually waited to hear the completion of the tune, as though she wanted all of us to hear the complete song. Next, she spoke so loudly that many others in the restaurant had to listen to her side of the conversation. Finally, I felt sorry for the person who was sitting with her, who also had to bear with the one-sided conversation. I wonder if the cell phone has invaded our society so much that good manners and common sense have been overridden by selfish habits and high technology gadgets. In a water cooler survey at the office, the two-way radio feature of certain cell phones seems to be the most irritating feature that was ever invented. Recently, a friend sent me an email message with a link to an online quiz about cellular phone etiquette. Although a little outdated, the year 2005, you might want to take a look at the technology faux pas and the ways to avoid such negative behavior when talking on the cell phone or radio. It's an image thing. This brings us to ham radio and our ability to instantly communicate with our fellow hams via VHF or UHF, VHF mobile or portable radios, also known as handy talkies or HTs. While the portable two-way radios that are carried by police officers and firefighters are usually viewed as cool gadgets, for some reason, the same or similar equipment on civilians or hams seems to be viewed as being nerdy. When in public view or when we are with non-ham friends, let's see if we can be polite and courteous to those around us by limiting the noise we make if we use our transceivers in public areas. Certainly, this can be an easy thing for us to do. We can just turn off the radio and conserve battery power. If we must communicate while in public places, accessory items such as external speaker, microphones, or headsets with boom-mounted microphones can be very useful tools to have. However, just like all good tools, these accessory items are only good if used correctly. Let's take a look at what these accessories can do and how to properly adjust and use these items. The speaker microphone. Speaker mic is exactly what it sounds like. It is a unit that includes a speaker for the receiver and a microphone for the transmitter in the single housing. These units look like miniature versions of a microphone intended for use with mobile radios. Some units include a volume control. Speaking of volume, when using these units, please do not crank up the volume so loud that the speaker distorts the sound and becomes an irritating noise to others around you. All speaker mics have a clip on the back so that you can clip the unit to your clothing. A good place to hold a speaker mic is on your shoulder so you can hear it and easily reach it when you are ready to transmit. The boom microphone headset provides an additional level of convenience and function. These units have a single or double-sided headphone for receiving and a microphone on a tube, and that's the boom, so you can locate the microphone close to your mouth. All of these units include a push-to-talk, that's PTT, button, and many have a feature called voice-operated switching, or VOX, V-O-X. If you have ever seen a television commercial for a product called the clapper, then you know what VOX operation is. The clapper is a sound-activated switch. At first, this VOX function seems to be a good feature to have since it enables hands-free operating. You do not have to push the button on the microphone or touch the radio in order to transmit. However, VOX control can be difficult to adjust properly. And it will allow unwanted noise to make the radio go into transmit mode unexpectedly. Since your voice is the trigger that puts the radio into transmit, you must always be aware of what you are saying, because it will be transmitted over the air. Can you imagine what could happen if you had your VOX-enabled microphone on? The normal reaction to this pain would be something most likely inappropriate for a radio audience, and possibly a violation of FCC Rule 97.113, that's prohibited transmissions. Now, by the way, this is exactly what is wrong with the clapper. Sometimes the switched item can be made to turn on or off unexpectedly because of some stray noise, such as a barking dog. Another bad thing about VOX operation is the hold time adjustment. It is possible to improperly adjust this control so that once triggered to transmit, the radio could go into lock mode and create the transmitter continuously, jamming the frequency. A much better solution to this VOX is an external switch for push-to-talk. This is the normal button on the microphone. Just about all of the boom microphone headsets available have a little control box that allows you to select either VOX or PTT. Plus, if you decide to get a headset, use the PTT function most often and use the VOX features only when you truly must have hands-free operation. For example, if you are climbing a tall tree to install a wire antenna and you want to use your HT to communicate with some helpers below, you may want to have the VOX control enabled. It is very natural to talk louder in noisy environments, such as a crowded restaurant or a busy industrial area. You may have to overcome the noise around you so the person you are talking to can hear as well as understand what you are saying. However, this is not the case when talking over the radio. Talking louder on the radio generally makes your signal more difficult to understand because the transceiver circuitry can limit or clip the sound of your voice, causing distortion. In addition, if the repeater you are using requires subtone access, talking too loudly into the microphone may distort the tone and the repeater system may not let your signal through. In some repeater systems, a sub-audible tone must be transmitted along with the radio signal in order to access the repeater system. Sometimes this is because the repeater is maintained by a club or group, and the use of the repeater system is limited to members only. And sometimes a sub-tone is used to prevent interference from another repeater system on the same or nearby frequency. Another term for sub-tone is continuous tone coded squelch system, CTCSS, and also Motorola's trademark called PL, or private line. Therefore, rather than shouting into the microphone when you are in a noisy environment, try to speak in a normal voice. Tom Wolfe, in the 1979 book and the 1983 movie titled The Right Stuff, describes how test pilot Chuck Yeager's cool and relaxed southern drawl remains controlled even under the most demanding life and death situations. Yeager was so well respected that other pilots imitated his calm and controlled tone while communicating to the ground crew. Even today, I think this may be true, because over the last 20-plus years, in 100% of the flights I have taken for business or pleasure, the captain's voice over the airplane public address system has that cool and reassuring tone. This should also be our model when communicating on the radio. If you must use your radio in noisy environments such as alongside a parade route or in a crowded restaurant, you may want to check your radio's operating manual to see if the microphone gain can be adjusted or have this done for you. A lower microphone gain setting will help reduce the amount of unwanted ambient noise around you. However, when you do this, you will have to speak louder or talk closer to the microphone every time you use your radio. An alternative to decreasing microphone gain is to hold the microphone so that it is as close as possible to your mouth. You will have to experiment to find the best mouth-to-microphone distance. The foam wind guard, if it has one, should be kept in place at all times. Our society is being invaded with over 200 million cell phone users in the United States. The ham radio population is several hundred thousand. Many hams own a portable 2-meter radio or a multi-band type of handy talkie, and some hams have more than one. When these two communication tools combine, or shall I say collide, there can be an increase in the irritation factor that ham radio sometimes generates. Let's try to be as considerate as possible with our portable operations and make sure we display the right stuff when communicating with our radios while in public view. This concludes the piece, Beginner's Corner, by Wayne Yoshida. Call KH6WZ. Let's go now to The Magic Band by author Carl Smith, called N4AA, November 4 Alpha Alpha. It's in the category of DX, Long Distance Communication, here on CQ Magazine's reading. The Magic Band. What do you do when the propagation on the high frequency bands is just not very good? Well, I can think of a lot of things, but they are not radio related and would involve manual labor. Such stuff as yard work, painting the house, etc. However, during the month of June and extending into July, there was an amazing amount of activity on the so-called magic band, 6 meters. I can say amazing because this is what the experts were saying. Records were set or broken, with Japanese stations being worked from all across the U.S. Europe was well represented, working into the U.S. too. You just never know what might happen on 6 meters. Last year, we were treated to some great openings, but this year, it was even better. You aren't on 6 meters? Many of the radios on the market these days include 6 meters, even less expensive ones such as my ICOM 706, which puts out 100 watts. Antennas are really quite small and easy to put up. They don't have to be big for you to have some fun and maybe put some interesting entries into your log. If you are interested in the ARRL's Challenge Award, those 6-meter contacts will add to your totals too. There have been some de-expeditions that were primarily for 6 meters as well. Dennis, K7BV, was active from Belize and the Galapagos in the June and July. CY0X from Sable Island was primarily a 6-meter operation. And TO5E was on from St. Bartholomew. All of these did operate some HF, but just to have something to do while waiting for 6 meters to open up. Now here's some commentary on upcoming expeditions. In checking my calendar of upcoming operations, I note the French operation from Glorioso is still being hoped for in the September-October time frame. As of early July, no new for information had been posted. Siggy, DL7DF, and his team are scheduled to be active as A25 slant Delta Lima 7 Delta Fox, September 23 through October 6. I'm not sure why, but Willis Island, VK9W, was ranked at 12, number 12 on the DX Magazine's Most Wanted Survey for 2007. There have been operations from Willis in the past, but apparently they failed to meet the demand. A team of 9 German operators and 1 Polish op will be on Willis in October. The website says they plan to be on the air from October 9 to the 27 with 4 stations, all with amplifiers, and the antennas will be the verticals that have become so popular for de-expeditioners. There is no information concerning an online log as of this writing. If you want to keep up with the plans, check out the following website, www.vk9dwx.de. Lots of operations are already being announced for the CQ Worldwide DX contests in October on single sideband and November for CW. A group of at least 5, led by Joe, W8GEX, will be going to St. Bartholomew. His group will be using the special call TO5DX, primarily for the CQ Worldwide Single Sideband Phone Contest. Before and after the contest, they will be active on CW, Single Sideband, RTTY. There are many others who are planning operations for the CQ Worldwide Contest, and you check them out on the website of Bill Fidd. His spelling is F-E-I-D-T, and his call is NG3K, November Golf 3 Kilo, who does an outstanding job of posting all this information for our benefit. Check that one out at www.ng3k.com/. A bit further on in the calendar, we find an operation from Papua, P2, late in October. This was announced back in April and little has been heard since. No website was announced, so just keep watching or listening after mid-October. Now, with regard to the Most Wanted Survey, I mentioned the DX Magazine Most Wanted Survey above. And I invite you to visit the DX Publishing website, www.dxpub.com, after September 1, and submit your own Most Wanted. This annual survey is used by de-expeditioners, DX foundations, clubs, and things like that, to help them decide which de-expeditions to help financially. The survey is conducted during September and October each year, with the results published in the January/February and March/April issues of the DX magazine. This year, the list has been expanded to include some 300 possible entities for you to choose from. Also, an extra column has been included for you to check if you need or want that entity on 160 through 30 meters. Both of these additions were made after careful consideration of suggestions made over the past several years. Now let's take a look at Logbook of the World. Now here is an interesting item from page 8 of the ARRL Annual Report for 2007. It's a quotation. Despite another year without many sunspots to spark the ionosphere, interest in awards chasing is increasing. Participation in the DX Century Club, that's DXCC, is up more than 1,000 applications over 2006 and is the highest it has been since 2001, when the last solar cycle peaked. Much of the interest in DXCC and ARRL's Worked All States WAS Award can be attributed to the strong use and performance of ARRL's Logbook of the World, LOTW, online QSO confirmation system, which links directly into those two awards. More than 150 million contacts have been loaded into Logbook of the World. Indeed, I am seeing more and more reports of logs being uploaded to the LOTW. I personally use it every few months to keep up to date for the band or mode confirmations that could be there. In case you missed it in the DX news sources recently, the logs for 4U1UN, that's for Uniform 1, Uniform November, for the last few years have been uploaded, and prior years were being worked on to get them uploaded as well. That's the United Nations station. I applaud anyone using the LOTW system. With the ever-increasing cost of postage, most notably from Europe to the United States, using the LOTW is dirt cheap in comparison. Sure, it's a little work, but after you have been through the process a few times, it isn't all that difficult. When you consider the cost of just one return envelope from some European countries costing at least $3 U.S., and it will get higher, I think you could spare a little time and effort to learn how to use the LOTW, don't you? Oh, no, some of the expeditioners might say. There goes our money for QSLing. I really don't think that is going to be a problem. The expeditions are not in the business of selling QSL cards anyway. Major the expeditions are using online donation systems with PayPal, etc., and I hear it is working just fine. In many cases, the QSL cards are being donated, and the only expense to a de-expedition would be the uploading of their logs to LOTW. Also, just think of all the time they would save by not having to handle all those paper requests. Well, until the next time, enjoy the chase and have fun. And it's signed 73 Carl, November 4, Alpha Alpha. Before I close today, there is that announcement relative to the 2008 CQ Worldwide DX Contest. CQ WWDX. The phone portion, that's the voice, October 25 through 26, starts 0000 Greenwich Mean Time on Saturday. The CW, or Morse code portion, November 29-30. It ends 2400 Greenwich Mean Time on Sunday. You know, folks, I recall reading a few minutes ago earlier in the digest form here that I was announcing the fact that the results of the 2008 CQ Worldwide DX Contest were available to you, and you should get someone to help you look at them if you needed them. That is the way it was printed out, and I think that, to me, was a typographical error, because the book or the magazine was really telling you that was the 2007 results, even though it's a September magazine right now. It does take quite a while to compile all of the information and the standings for the winners or not winners in a huge, huge contest like this. So that was the 2007 results back there a few minutes ago, and this announcement is for the 2008 CQ Worldwide DX Contest for phone, October 25-26, and CW, November 29-30. Now, briefly stated, the objective is for amateurs around the world to contact other amateurs in as many zones and countries as possible. It's all bands, 1.8 through 28 megahertz, except for the WARC bands. And you have to pick your categories. And if you're not familiar with that, you ought to check with some friends in the ham radio community in your area. That brings me up to just about time for this month's reading of CQ Magazine in digest form here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ Magazine is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. United States of America. The editor is Richard S. Mawson, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at telephone 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. A great website at www.handyham.org. Now remember, folks, this is Bob Zeida, that spells Z-E-I-D-A. My amateur radio call sign is November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, N1BLF. I'm located, QTH is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, near good old Buzzards Bay in Cape Cod. My email is my call sign, N1BLF@comcast.net. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks a lot for listening to this first offering by the Courage Handy Ham System of CQ Magazine, 7388.